Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. We are officially nearing the end of the daily episodes that I've been posting since early March. This has been, I don't want to say fun because this is happening in response to a horrific war, but it's been a really enlightening process. I've learned a lot. I know the audience has learned a lot, and I'm trying to put a lot of thought into how this should shape the show moving forward. So this is a definite opportunity for folks to email in at realignmentpod@gmail.com or apply to the Substack, because I'm spending this week, aside from taping the last episodes, thinking about the future. Today's episode is a great one. I'm speaking with Rupert Russell. He's the author of Price Wars, How Commodities Markets Make Our Chaotic World. This actually came in through an audience suggestion. An audience member read this book and they said, hey, this is a great fit for your coverage of the Ukraine crisis and everything else moving forward. So basically the topic of this episode is how commodities markets, aka the prices of everything from wheat to issues like energy and fertilizer, how that actually influences and doesn't influence conflict. So we're going to start by focusing on how Russell thinks that the coverage of this topic is really defined by commodities prices. But then we're going to zoom out and look at the broader critique of markets and global capitalism that the realignment has always been interested in. So lots of great stuff. For today's specific shout out to the audience, a quick note on how to access different things. So I've got a couple emails from folks saying, hey, how do I tip? How do I subscribe to the newsletter? Where do I find the bookshop link? It is directly in the actual description for the episode. So if you're in Spotify, if you're on Apple, if you just click on the episode and scroll down below the description of the episode, you will find all the links there to everything you need. That said, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting the work of this podcast, and I look forward to wrapping this series and all of your thoughts on what we should do moving forward. Hope you enjoy the episode. Rupert Russell, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're here. I was mentioning this before we started, but this is a booking that was at the recommendation of a listener. So seriously, listeners, if you ever read a book that you really enjoy, be sure to follow up, drop us an email, a Substack, whatever. We'll get them booked in the show, especially when their book is particularly interesting, such as yours, Rupert. So let's just start here. You're telling a story of how, in your view, so much of the chaos of the 2010s and now even the 2020s can be explained by what's happening in commodity markets. So let's just start with definitions then. What are commodity markets?
Sure. So the basic things that we sort of, the raw materials that we need to survive, right? So that can be food, we're talking wheat, corn, and so forth. It could be even be talking fertilizer. In some cases, although that's manufactured good, I'm getting ahead of myself now. But obviously metals is a huge one. And energy, gas, oil. So these are commodities. We call them commodities often because they can be substituted for each other, more or less. It's not strictly true. You can get into different kinds of oil or different kinds of wheat. But the idea is that more or less these things are interchangeable. And because they're interchangeable, we can have one global price for all of them. And so that's when you see, you know, oil's hitting $90 a barrel or $120 a barrel. That price is referring to kind of the global market. So we live in a world of raw materials, and they're globally priced. And I think that's kind of the foundation of what I'm talking about.
So speaking of what you're talking about then, let's just say, get a good summary of your thesis when it comes to how these global events are actually driven by these actual commodities, as opposed to global events happen and then we should look at the commodities after the fact. Is that a good way of setting up how you're thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the fascinating thing about price, and the book is in a way an exploration of sort of what is price, right? Because price has two components to it, right? There are things that make prices, which we could think of that as kind of, you know, for oil, it could be how much oil is Russia making or Saudi, or how much is Biden going to relieve from the reserve, and how much oil do people want to buy, right? That can be one way of thinking about price. But price also has effects, right? So when prices are high, that may hit, you know, American consumers in their wallet, but it will also fund petrostates. It will also give money to sort of Saudi Arabia and Russia and so forth. And what I found in the book is that essentially this is essentially a feedback loop whereby you have High commodity prices can spark chaos in the real world, and then that real world chaos then gets called priced back into the markets, creating higher prices. And so what I actually sort of discovered was that prices kind of functioned as a sort of engine, right? They kind of take something that might be happening in Russia or happening in Ukraine, or for that matter in the American Midwest in kind of wheat fields, and then it makes it global because prices are global, and then that can then create a shock somewhere else, and then that in turn gets priced back into markets. And so essentially what we've seen over the 2010s, but also in the 1970s and even earlier in history, whereby prices end up becoming these engines of chaos. And that's why when we talk about the 1970s, we talk about it just like that, as a decade. The same is true with the 2010s, right? So at least in our minds, we have this idea of these kind of prolonged periods of time. And the reason why they're prolonged is because they have these feedback effects that keep on running and running and running.
So we'll get into the 2010s specifically, but I want to note that we're doing this as part of our 30-day daily series on the Ukraine conflict. So you're providing a frame by which people should think about conflicts such as this one, but how would you interpret the events or the aftershocks of the Ukraine conflict through the lens you're describing? Because I've heard the words fertilizer, to your point earlier, wheat, all of these different commodities. I've never heard them be referenced as many times as frankly any of us who's consuming news have been in the past month.
That's a good point. I spent the last couple of years writing this book banging on about just those things, and everyone thought I was a bit crazy. And now, as you say, it's the headlines of the Financial Times, Bloomberg, BBC, New York Times. We're all sort of having to kind of become experts on this, right? So the way in which I see the Ukraine crisis is this. So it starts last year, right? For an easy starting point. There's trouble in China. There's political contestation going inside the Chinese elite, which, long story short, leads to a shortfall in coal, right? So what do the Chinese start doing instead? They buy a substitute commodity, gas. They're buying tons of gas.
Wait, quick pause. This is an hour-long podcast, so I do want the long story version. Why did that lead to a shortfall in coal?
Sure. So you essentially had Xi having an anti-corruption crackdown in China, and coal companies got caught in the crosshairs of this. And so people were reluctant to kind of invest in coal and keep the coal mines going because of this political risk that was attached inside the Chinese state. You also had the pandemic was hitting China as well, and they had closed their border to Mongolia. So trains of coal that would normally be coming in and supplying China also weren't coming in. As far as I understand it, could of course be wrong, she was pretty unaware of this and got kind of caught flat-footed, if you like, around last autumn or maybe September, October or so. And of course, they've got to get their energy from somewhere. And so they switched to gas, which is quite common, which is why one of the reasons why these energy commodities correlate to each other, right? Because if you run out of one, it's not super easy to do, but as we're talking right now in Europe, perhaps switching to coal as well. So China begins buying a ton of gas last autumn. And this is sort of where we begin to see the rise of energy commodity prices, right? Oil starts rising around this time as well. And the European energy companies are reluctant to refill their inventories with these high prices, right? So the bet that's going on inside Europe is prices are really high now for gas. We'll probably be able to pick this up in a couple of months at a much lower rate. So Europe has low inventories. The price of oil is also shooting up as well. Now, what does this do, right? This is a huge boom to anybody who exports gas and oil. So this is a windfall for Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, and of course, the Kremlin as well. Now, an interesting kind of factoid I came across in sort of researching the book was that when you look at the last commodity price highs, the last three, in the last, say, 40, 50 years, each time Russia invades someone, right? So 1979, the Iranian Revolution, oil prices explode. It's called the Iran shock. December 1979, Soviet tanks roll into Afghanistan. 2008, another famous commodity super spike. That's when Putin rolls tanks into Georgia. And then 2014, the kind of beginning of the current conflict, came right at the end of a sort of a three-year high from 2011 to 2014. I mean, he didn't know it was going to collapse months later, but it essentially did. So I think it was around January, April, things really start going in Ukraine, and oil's trading at around $90 to $100 a barrel, which now might not seem so high, but then was extremely high, historically speaking. So I interviewed a brilliant political scientist called Colin Hendricks, who'd done a lot of research on this. And he had done studies into looking at, you know, 50 years of conflicts, large and small, and correlated the aggressiveness of petrostates to oil prices. And sure enough, he found that the higher the oil price ticks up, the more chesty, as he calls it, these kind of states become. So here you have a situation, this is now the fall, December of 2021, you've got depleted inventories in Europe, you've got rising oil prices, rising gas prices as well, you've got the Kremlin's coffers are beginning to become inflated. Now, I went to Donbass, Eastern Ukraine for the book, there's a chapter on it there, and I was looking in the origins of this conflict, and what sort of struck me about it being there, and I went, I think, 2018, the winter of 2018, was this, it felt like suspended animation, right? Live just put on hold, right? A lot of the scenes we're seeing now, it still looks like that in parts of Donbass, except without the dead bodies on the street, right? You've got bombed out houses, bombed out cars. And this was sort of 5 years after the start of this war. And I kept thinking to myself, as an unanswered question in the book, like, how does this end, right? What is the end point? And the end point was oil prices going back up to where they were in 2014, right? We don't want to have a too mechanistic model of how we think about these things. But with the oil, but with the low and energy prices from 2014 to 2021, it may simply have been that Putin just simply didn't have the resources to pull off something like this. And crucially, it's not just that the Kremlin has a kind of windfall to either spend on the military or have in foreign currency reserves. It's the flip side of this as well. It's that Europe is even more dependent on Russia when prices are high, right? Because by definition, it means that gas or oil are scarce and it's not easy for them to substitute it. So it also means that not only is his hand strengthened, but his opponent's hands are sort of also weakened. And there's a sort of a last piece to this, which is that towards the end of last year, so we're talking, you know, 2021, December plus January this year, you know, we start hearing reports or increasingly hearing reports of, you know, Russian battle groups on the border, Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova, etc. in the news. Now, this has a further effect, and this is this feedback loop I was mentioning earlier. By putting those military units around Ukraine, that increases geopolitical risk, right? It's essentially saying that, you know, there could be in the future some sort of conflict which could impact commodity prices. And what happens with the way our markets are set up is that risk gets priced into the markets. So just the possibility of there being a war, not a war itself, ends up increasing prices. And of course, this is the exact kind of cycle that I'm trying to sort of describe, whereby rising prices lead to increased militarism leads to rising prices. And it may well have been this feedback effect which gave Putin the confidence to do something in February 2022 that he may have been wanting to do ever since oil prices crashed in 2014.
Yeah, so a couple follow-ups to that. Number one would be, how should we think of this balance between, let's say, ideas, ideology, and these prices, commodity discussion that you're having here? So, for example, you could say the stalemate ending was driven by that 2021 high. But when we were discussing Ukraine, you could discuss everything from NATO expansion to maybe Putin thought that Trump was going to win re-election and he was going to withdraw from NATO. And therefore, this would have been the time to do it. So why take the risk before the 2020 election? How do you think of the balance there? Because, like, you know, because once again, like there are critiques of books, and a critique of your book, as you know, is that you are taking a theory and trying to apply it to these complicated situations. How would you just respond to that dynamic there?
Sure. So the way that I outline it in the book is I have this metaphor of kind of monsters and mazes, right? So if you go on to Twitter, God willing, you will see all kinds of different monster stories. Like, we love monster stories as people. I love horror movies. It's another conversation. But, you know, and that's sort of a genre that we've adopted, right? And all of these kind of dictators, we sort of turn them into monsters. And by the way, I'm totally fine with that, right? People are monsters. I'm willing to accept the absolute worst possible versions of all of these people, whether it's ISIS or Saddam Hussein or Xi or Putin, and like, that's all completely fine, right? Because what I'm talking about is the maze. It's an overlooked part of the horror genre. But it's crucial, right? You think about Alien, right? Alien running around the spaceship, right? If it was a big open plane, the alien would just run to Ripley and just kill her, and the movie would be over after, you know, 2 minutes. There would be no film there, right? Or you think...
Not that scary, to be honest. It's pretty obvious.
Exactly.
There it is.
Think about... or the mall in Dawn of the Dead with all the zombies going around the mall, right? Or you think about The Shining, right? Where it ends in a literal labyrinth, right? Of... Jack Nicholson running around with an axe. And that's the way that I consider these commodity markets, right? They're the maze, right? They are the structure of opportunity and constraint. I don't propose at any point in the book to get into anybody's heads. I don't know what Putin's really thinking, or for that matter, ISIS or Xi. I'm quite willing to say that, sure, he just wants to, out of some, it could be nostalgia for the Soviet Union, it could be NATO, it could be this, it could be that. But let's just assume he wants to go and cause chaos somewhere, right? To do that, he's got to do it with something, right? You need an army, you need foreign currency reserves, you need your opponents to be weakened. And that's, for me, how we should think about geopolitics. We should think about it as a structure of opportunity and constraint. And then we can then leave the kind of the psychologizing of Putin to sort of, to historians or psychologists or other people. That's fine, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with speculating what's in these people's heads, right? But I'm not sure if it's a super predictive model of how they're going to behave. Whereas I think when you look at things like prices, and this is where the political science literature, I think, is extremely clear, we have a very, very highly predictive model. And again, you know, what's happening in the last year is sort of exactly as my book might sort of predict it does.
Man, that's, we do have a lot of metaphors in zeitgeisty spaces like podcasting. I love that metaphor because, and correct me if I'm interpreting this wrong, because, like, once again, I think mm-hmm. the purpose of this book is to give people a mental framework for thinking about this. So there Absolutely. Was, before the invasion, there is this debate. Is Putin going to do it? And some of the inputs that we put in were, okay, he has plasma on the border. There are support staff that you wouldn't have if this were a typical training exercise. Therefore, we could put those in as inputs that could help us assess whether an invasion would happen. It seems to me that what you are suggesting is that one of the inputs that one could have taken to that debate was, well, if he were going to invade, commodity prices, these structural factors are actually at a point where this would be not in the sense advantageous to him, but this would be feasible for him in a way that this conversation could look different, let's say, in 2017. Is that a good way of interpreting how you're saying this?
Yeah, exactly. It definitely comes down to probability, right? So this isn't saying that every petro state will invade somebody. But what the model does say is it's just a lot more likely, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a lot more likely for reasons that are just pretty obvious, right? When Europe has basically no gas in its inventory, that is a great time to launch some kind of anything really that Europe isn't going to like, right? So in some ways it's a simplistic model, but that was sort of the aim of the book. The aim of the book is to simplify everything down from the last 10 years, because I think what can happen to us is two things. One is we silo things. So we go, okay, what's happening in Ukraine and Russia has nothing to do with what's happening in Yemen or say in Venezuela or with ISIS in Iraq. So that's one thing I'm sort of arguing against. And the other thing is that will happen is it just looks just too complicated, right? There's just too many factors. When you go to, you know, I visit a lot of these countries and you talk to people, say, in Venezuela, and people sit down and talk to you for hours about the intricacies of Venezuelan opposition parties, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And of course, that's all totally relevant. But when you're looking at these kind of big global changes or big global shifts, the theory I came up with at the end was that maybe we don't need to know, we don't need to know every single thing that necessarily happens, right? Like, you can predict that with that, imagine there's a kind of Jenga tower, right, of blocks. You can kind of predict that if you pull that one out from the bottom, the whole thing is going to tumble. You don't need to know exactly to be able to predict the movement of every single one of those blocks. You just know on an intuitive level, right, you pull that one out, the whole thing is going to come down. And that's exactly how I'm thinking about this, right? Commodity prices are like one of those blocks at the bottom of a Jenga tower, right? You put them in, you put them out, it's going to affect the entire tower. And we don't need to know every single thing about how that tower is constructed to know that it's going to come down.
I want to get to the bigger picture, but something I'm just thinking about as you're describing petrostate aggression, I'm wondering what commodities, especially oil / energy, looked like if you are looking at Iraq in the 1980s and in like early 1990s. So you, for example, you have the Iran-Iraq war, which goes on for 8 years. You then have Saddam Hussein expanding into Kuwait, which leads to the American / global response with Desert Storm. How did that commodity picture look like in that example?
Ooh, that's a big question. I had an interesting conspiracy theory about the Iraq story, which I'll sort of share with you. So you're a petrostate. Let me put it differently. So when you think about prices, this is the kind of standard economic model of prices, right? The idea is that prices are the world's best guess of what will happen in the future, right? So you've got all these traders, all these speculators, and by traders, that includes people who are doing the physical markets and also people kind of in Chicago or New York betting on futures. And the idea is that this price is the best predictor. Now, we also know from standard economics that the best way to predict a price is to have inside information, right? It's the classic plot of Oliver Stone's Wall Street, right? Or even in things like The Big Short, the whole plot revolves around somebody figuring something out before other people. And sort of on Wall Street, you've got all these equity analysts and they're looking at all these firms. Maybe in the 80s, it's kind of Xerox or Atari that they're all kind of obsessing over. And the analysts are obviously separate from the companies. But in commodities, that's not true, right? So one interesting thing, I talked to a trader about this who remembers the 1991 invasion vividly. And he said that right before the invasion of Iraq, Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, the oil price started ticking up. And he was a trend follower. And so what trend followers do is they're very rule-based in how they trade. And he bought oil futures, thinking, right, somebody in the market somewhere knows something. And then, of course, a couple of weeks later, Saddam invades and the oil futures shoot up. And all those people on that side of the trade made a lot of money. Now, this begs the question, as he put it to me, why were oil futures going up? Well, somebody in the market knew something was going to happen. And that person was Saddam Hussein, right? So you can kind of easily see a scenario where Putin as well, all these other leaders of petrostates, when they know they're going to engage in a military action, they use the futures markets to their advantage because they literally have the inside information. And so the way that I think about this is that we can't see these actors as kind of passive, right? It's a feedback loop. The people who benefit from the prices going up are the people who are in essence rewarded by the market for bad behavior. And that could also be Saudi Arabia's world war in Yemen, ginning up the risk premium as much as it is Putin and Russia.
Yeah, so let's zoom out a bit and get at the bigger picture here. So we keep making references back to the 2010s. And mm-hmm. This podcast is called The Realignment. And so much of this podcast in terms of our origin was driven by here are our responses to these events. So 2008 financial crisis, the Brexit referendum, the election of Donald Trump, obviously there's COVID. So there are all these big, big, big events in the 2010s in a way that there weren't big events in the 1990s, shall we say. So what is your, I don't want to say contrarian because it seems like you kind of just threw that out there, but because that's contrarian has taken on certain meaning, especially on Twitter to the earlier reference, but what is your retelling of this? Actually, no, let me set this up in a better way. What is the conventional story of these 2010s events? And how does your story differ because it's looking at it from a different perspective?
Sure. So how I feel about the, or how I see the 20, it's just obviously this is the subjective part of the story. How I feel the conventional wisdom on the 2010s, and I actually lived in America for 10 years, and then I moved back to the UK the day after Brexit. So both the Brexit and the Trump and the Obama phenomenon for me were all sort of quite things I lived through one way or the other.
Was that date timed? You just happened to...
Just total coincidence, yeah. And the way that I see these stories as being told or explained is they're monster stories, as I mentioned earlier, right? And sometimes I don't mean monster in necessarily like a pejorative way, right? So I think Trump himself kind of styles himself as kind of cartoonish and kind of villainish. And he's often, you know, he actually was part of kind of WWF, right? I've seen the clips on YouTube. You can find them of him getting in the boxing ring. And whether it's ISIS or again Putin or Xi or even Maduro in Venezuela, whether it's Nigel Farage, even these right-wing populists like Le Pen start doing very well. The way in which it's kind of packaged, and that's also them packaging themselves, ISIS as well, packaged themselves as monsters and kind of sold that to us sort of through YouTube videos, was two things. One is the main aspect of that was that the what's causing events to be driven forward is these individuals, right? It's the force of these personalities. And so if we want to understand these events, we have to get inside Trump's head or Nigel Farage's head or Putin or Xi, as we're constantly sort of seeing. And what this does is it gives us a very siloed idea of this, right? So we're putting each of these different headlines in a different sort of silo. And I think what I tried to do in the book was to do two things. One, as I mentioned earlier, and to say, well, okay, let's assume they are all monsters. That doesn't explain why they all broke out onto the world stage in the 2010s. Nigel Farage had been around for ages. So had Le Pen. Even Trump had run for president before, right? These figures were not necessarily particularly new. ISIS wasn't new. That dated back to the early 2000s in Iraq. So there was some kind of uncaging event, right? Where suddenly these people who'd been around, knocking around for maybe a decade or two, were suddenly empowered and thrust onto the world stage. Now, the financial crisis itself, rightly, has been seen as a source of political disorder and chaos in the Western Europe. And that story's been very well told, whether it's Adam Tooze's book Crashed, whether it's McKay's film The Big Short, in Michael Lewis's books. It's been a well-told story, and I think we're sort of familiar with this. And what my book is sort of saying is they're going, well, that was actually just the first detonation in the global markets, 2008. There was one just prior to it, a global food crisis. And more importantly, there was another food crisis, a food price spike in 2010. And so you actually had three detonations in a row. And the reason why the other two are not sort of discussed and aren't really in the public consciousness is just simply because their effects were felt in the developing world. They were felt in Africa, they were felt in Asia, even South America. And therefore they just, you know, They were written about in the New York Times or the BBC, but they weren't kind of integrated into sort of our analysis simply because people felt it didn't relate to them. And what I sort of do in the book is I basically draw this sort of butterfly effect where you have chaos in New York and London, the world's financial centers. It then goes out across the world and then comes back in the form of various refugee crises. Actually, there's sort of more than one that I sort of mentioned, and it does come back. And shall I outline that now or?
In a second, I was just as you're describing this, you know, the words like chaos and caging event, how do these figures rise? I just thought we're doing lots of pop culture references this episode, so we'll just keep the train going there. Geez, a lot of mixed metaphors too. But I think it was season two or season three Game of Thrones where Littlefinger says, you know, chaos is a ladder, back when Game of Thrones was good. So it's just useful to think of. To just go back to that frame, but yeah, just please go on.
Sure. So you have the global food crisis, the financial crisis, and the global food price spike. So with food, you see it kind of spike twice like this when you see it kind of on a graph. And I think the way to think about this was that these three detonations were felt globally almost as sort of one event, right? So when you look, for example, at World Surveys of Hunger, 2008 it's here, then 2009, then 2010, right? So this is like a cumulative impact, but it's huge. And so the 2010 one in particular.
Wait, real quick, why was there a, so once again, to your point, I think listeners at this point have the basic Big Shorty version of the financial crisis, but why was there a global food price spike in 2008?
Extremely controversial question. I take the point of view in the point of view that I take is that this was really driven by the financialization of the commodity markets. So between essentially in 2000, there was a massive deregulation of the markets called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and sort of Wall Street speculators went from being 20% of that market, or open interest as it called, being essentially 80 to 90%. And what you begin to see, it takes a couple of years for this to kind of kick in. So around 2005, it really begins to kick in. And ever since 2005, we've just seen more and more and more volatility in these markets, almost higher every single year. The reason why I buy that argument in a nutshell and not the... And by the way, sorry, that argument was made by people on Wall Street, right? That's how we know about it. There was a hedge fund manager called Michael Masters in 2008, who famously gave an extensive presentation to Congress saying, look, the way in which speculation is working is out of control, and the markets are no longer kind of responding to reality. The easiest way to think about this is that when you look at a graph of sort of global food production, every single year it goes up. Right. So in 2007, made more food than 2006, 2008, 2007, 2010 was more food produced than any other than history. Right. And yet we're having global food crises. So something in this market mechanism is going haywire. In the 2008 instance, what it looks like happened was that the housing market was collapsing in 2007. And so you have this capital being pulled out of the housing market. And that capital has to go somewhere, and it goes to two places. It goes, some of it goes into the stock market, but another portion of it goes into commodities. And the commodity markets are actually very small, right? We may think of them as huge, but compared to things like housing or just, you know, other financial assets, they're kind of minuscule. So you don't need a huge amount of this capital to kind of send prices going haywire. So you see, right as housing coming down, you see commodities in the stock market booming up, and then right as the financial crisis kind of peaks, it then collapses almost immediately. And as one hedge fund manager put it to me, he said, the speculators just needed all their money back, right? You've got that mortgage to pay for your Long Island mansion, you've got your kids' school fees to pay, clients are pulling out of your fund, and so you've got to sell. And so that's why we see this collapse. In 2010,
and sorry, I just going to keep asking follow-ups. Yeah. I think this is really, really interesting, because I want to get to the capitalism critique towards the end. So I'm setting this up well here. What is the other side of the story, right? So like, for example, if we're looking at this neoliberalism, post-1990s, deregulatory, there's the critique, and then there's what people are trying to do. So when folks deregulated that market in 2000, when you say this is a controversial question, what's the mm-hmm. other side of that controversy relative to your story?
Well, you may get the best answers asking them.
I don't mean to constrain you to like argue against yourself.
Yeah, no, but I mean, they may quibble with what I would say, but I will definitely, I write about this in the book. I write about what Alan Greenspan said would happen. So the charge to deregulate the markets was driven by Alan Greenspan. And there was this sort of now kind
chairman
of
the Federal Reserve at the time.
Quite, through the 1990s.
Not for you, for the audience.
And he, at the time in the 1990s, derivatives were growing. Now, these derivatives that were controversial at the time were relating really to other financial assets and other financial entities like interest rates, currencies, mortgage-backed securities, lovely things like that we're also now quite familiar with. But because the original derivatives came from the commodity markets, right? You may have heard of like wheat futures, pork belly futures. It's a contract derived from a physical thing. So all a wheat future is saying is, we're going to agree upon a price to deliver me, I don't know, some oil or some wheat in a couple of months from now. So you might call it a May contract or a June contract. That literally just means for delivery, and that gives the person making the commodity or producing it some security, right? So it means that I can, you know, do my harvest this summer knowing that I can deliver my wheat the following year for a certain price, and that means I can get a loan from the bank, and it means I can pay my farmhands and so forth. So this all dates back to the mid-19th century. And what had happened was in the 1930s is Roosevelt had passed legislation to create these limits on speculation. Because that previous era from around the mid-19th century to the 1920s, there had been many chaotic episodes in the commodities markets. And farmers had been lobbying year after year after year to get the federal government involved, because people were just making these crazy bets and was pushing prices around, and like nobody was really benefiting this from this other than the other speculators. So Roosevelt comes in, puts in these regulations. Fast forward to the 1990s. So you have a handful of derivative detonations, right? As you would now kind of understand it in kind of the Big Short sense, where everyone's kind of looking around going, what just happened? I'm now poor. This exactly had happened. It happened in two famous instances. One was Orange County and the other was Procter & Gamble, if I'm correct. And my memory serves me right. I think these were losses in the hundreds of millions. I think Orange County may have lost $2 billion, but I'd have to check my notes on that. And so Brooksley Braun, who was the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, regulating these derivatives, fell underneath her purview. And she decided that she was going to put out a white paper. Technically, they called it a concept release, asking for input to say, right, what are these new things? They weren't regulated. They were kind of private agreements between these entities that I guess you would go to a bank and say, I want insurance on an interest rate. And they would write you a kind of a bespoke contract. And the backlash was huge. So there's this famous line from Larry Summers that was reported in the Washington Post, where he calls up Brooksley Braun and says, look, if you do this, i.e. go ahead and release this paper asking for feedback on regulations of derivatives, I've got 13 bankers in my office that say you're going to cause the worst financial crisis since World War II. Brooksley Braun ignores Larry Summers and decides to do this concept, release this white paper anyway. Now, there was no worst financial crisis since World War II. And instead, what happened was Greenspan, Summers, and other members of the Clinton administration kind of got together and organized this ambush hearing on Brooksley Braun. And it's a fascinating document because in it, you see the promise of deregulated derivative markets, right? And Greenspan's entire argument is derivatives are insurance mechanisms. They're a way to dissipate risk, right? As I was saying with the earlier example with wheat futures, the idea is, you know, you're giving the farmer security. He can hedge risk, or she, by buying one of these futures contracts. And so the more that we allow these derivatives to grow, the more the institutions can insure themselves, and this insurance will be dissipated, obviously, globally. So even if there is a shock in, say, the Florida housing market, they'll be insured in Singapore, in Hong Kong, we'll have the other side of these contracts. And so you really begin to see this, and Greenspan uses this wonderful phrase. He says, there's a new world out there, and this is why you should deregulate not just derivatives, but you should also repeal Glass-Steagall and let the banks get even bigger. Now, we know how this story ends, right? 2008, the whole thing detonates, and Greenspan is going to hold before Congress in 2009. And Greenspan says, my ideology was flawed. And he just confesses to it, right? His entire model that he predicted was not true. People were not using derivatives to insure products. They were using them to make risky bets on the one hand. But there was another piece of evidence which Michael Masters presented to Congress in 2008. It was from a report from Goldman Sachs, who was one of the figures selling a lot of these derivatives as they applied to commodities. Commodities got sort of deregulated almost like as an afterthought to this process. They were really focused on things like housing derivatives, and they just kind of threw in energy and minerals, I guess, for the fun of it. and right before Michael Masters gives his famous testimony, he actually shows a piece of a Goldman Sachs report from months prior, saying, oh yeah, our derivatives, our funds are increasing the prices, right? Goldman Sachs, of course, changed its mind on this kind of months afterwards, and now we have this kind of phony debate about whether or not kind of Goldman Sachs had a role to play in this when they admitted that they already did. So for me, when I'm assessing these claims, I just sort of look at what were the players saying at the time, what did they say was going to happen, and then what was reality?
So I'll be fair to you and let you get to 2010. I skipped all these courses during college, so I appreciate you giving the background on it. But so 2010, the third detonation, and then now take us to present day, I'm assuming.
Exactly, that's right. So the third detonation is based on two things. So one is fears of wildfires in Russia. So you have lots of new news reports at the time saying there's wildfires all over Russian crops. This is going to create a huge dent in the global wheat production. So, you know, supply goes down, price goes up. You start seeing a lot of capital flowing into wheat futures. Along with that, you get another thing on Wall Street. People are very nervous about inflation. Even though we were in a global recession, capitalized as the Great Recession, the Fed's response with QE, quantitative easing, essentially printing money, or their bond buying program, as sort of they would put it, created a lot of fear this was going to lead to runaway inflation, and commodities is an inflation hedge. So you essentially have different narratives sort of swirling around at the time, and they kind of begun to reinforce each other, right? So once you start hearing a story about rising prices, you buy, that causes the price to rise, create a feedback loop, and essentially by the end of 2010, wheat prices double, and this also leads global food prices double, because wheat is such an important component of global food prices. In the Middle East, for example, it's about 35% of where people get their calories from, and it's also imported globally. So that imported price, that global price, is absolutely sort of crucial. So what do we end up seeing? We end up seeing riots and revolutions first break out in Tunisia, then in Egypt, then Jordan, and then it spreads Yemen, Syria, and so forth. We'd also seen riots and revolutions in 2008 on a much smaller scale. And so you kind of have, as I said, this cumulative effect. Or another way to think about it would be like an avalanche, right? You're dripping that great grain of sand on a big sand pile, and then eventually the whole thing just kind of tumbles. Again, the motivations for riots and revolutions are manifold. I went to Tunisia in 2014. I interviewed Rashid Ghannouchi, the head of the Islamist party, Ennahda. And yeah, they were very angry about religious repression, and rightly so. He had been a prisoner in Ben Ali and Bourguiba's jails. And so you always have, there's always many motivations for people to go out onto the streets and call for regime change. But these also weren't new, right? So again, these are decades old resentments, but it's this sort of shock from the global commodity market that sort of triggers this sort of earthquake across the region. Now, these riots become revolutions, and in two countries immediately, this ends up descending into civil war, Libya and Syria. And these sort of becomes the breeding ground for ISIS, and also becomes the origin of the global refugee crisis. So in the first years of those civil wars, you have refugees spilling into neighboring countries. It could be Tunisia, it could be Lebanon. But by 2015-16, it goes global, right? So you suddenly have these massive migrant flows into Europe. And 2015 is when you begin to see the populist wave in Europe, or as you put it, the realignment, right? This is, I think, when, if I'm correct, this is when Italy has a populist government, when Poland has a populist government. A year later, you have Brexit in the UK. And even though the global refugee crisis didn't really hit the US in the same way, those images were widely circulated and sort of on the news, right? And so Trump would talk a lot about ISIS in the 2016 campaign. He would kind of go to Detroit and say, you know, Hillary Clinton would rather give a job to a refugee from abroad than to an African-American in Detroit. So he was definitely talking up this rhetoric, and you could see it on the TV strings. And Rick, so what we have
well, quick follow up on the refugee question, and it's not a refugee, it's a migration issue. Because operationally, that's what the issue is with driving those conflicts. Did that at all drive any of these dynamics at all drive mid-2010s migration from Central and Latin America to the United States? Because that's a Trump. That's I think that's very, like, once again, build the wall. That's the very, very, very direct example of how migration issues were defining for Trump. I'm curious if there's anything in your story here.
Absolutely. So I also went to Guatemala. I went to Central America in 2019 to look at precisely this question of the U.S. border crisis that was the summer of 2019. Prior to that, migration from Mexico and Central America had actually been down. It had been down historically, even in 2016. But in 2019, you had this huge surge. I think it was around 500,000. Could be wrong, but I think it's roughly 500,000. The largest country represented in that was Guatemala. So I went to Guatemala. And again, we have a story that combines two stressors. So again, there's a long-term stressor, climate change. Climate change had been impacting Guatemala for decades. It had been regularly listed as a country most at risk of sort of climate disruption. And then what happens in 2018? Global coffee prices collapse, right? So you look at a graph, it just kind of slopes downwards like this. Now, a lot of people in Guatemala depend on the coffee economy, either directly as sort of coffee farmers, or you might work in kind of local restaurants or bakery shops, things like that, that depend on that income. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that climate change stressor was increasing their production costs because they've got to buy more fertilizer. Climate change has been essentially leading to a fungus on the plants, where they call it roya, rust. And every year they've got to spend more and more money on these fertilizers to treat this fungus. So their costs are going up, and they then get hammered by the price. And not only that, in order to fund their harvest, they have to, many of them have to go to local moneylenders, and they essentially mortgage their property, and they say, and they are charged an extortionate interest rate. They're charged 10% a month, which is 120% a year, right? So they really are sort of on the edge of chaos, right? Just a very, very small change in the price can lead you to bankruptcy. If you can't pay back these money lenders, it's not just, oh, we're earning 10% less last year or 20% last year. It's we're going to lose everything, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happens in these times is there's this huge migratory move sort of northward. Of course, it wasn't sort of presented as this. And sort of, again, sort of the thesis of my book I keep coming back to is that the source of chaos, especially these large price swings, is really happening in the West. It's being driven by New York, Chicago, London. It has these ripple effects out to the rest of the world, in this case, Guatemala. But it then comes back again in the form of a refugee crisis, or as Trump was calling them, these sort of invading migrant caravans, right? Whatever his monster story was, or barbarians at the gate that he was telling. And then that then creates political disorder inside the United States.
Yeah, and I want to go to the monster metaphor for a second, because I think, once again, given the origins in your horror maze metaphor, that makes total sense. But I think a useful way for any Trumpy audience members to think about is just even the focus on the individual. So I'm just curious, like, as an author, you know, as a PhD who's obviously taking a very empirical approach to this, how do you think of individuals and leaders within this framework? How did this help you reassess how we should think of figures? Because, like, as to your point, whenever we discuss everything, it's very, very personalized. It's, is Putin Hitler? Is Joe Biden Neville Chamberlain? And whether or not those metaphors are quite accurate, there's complication within anyone you could choose, obviously, but there's still something individualistic about it. So how do you just think about that when you're writing this book and, frankly, talking about these issues?
This is a good question. I began by almost like a challenge, really, which is to sort of say, I guess at the beginning I was thinking, well, what if we just looked at prices, right? What would that tell us? How much of the Talmud in the 2010s could it explain, right? Well, it could explain, I go through these case studies, or Venezuela, Iraq, Ukraine, Guatemala. It didn't explain necessarily Burma. It didn't explain Afghanistan, right? So it didn't explain every single thing that happened. But then as I kind of got towards the end of the book, I've been to these countries and I kind of written it up as this sort of gonzo adventure, as kind of following this butterfly effect. But I wanted to sort of have a better understanding of, well, why is the maze set up the way it's set up? Mm. And so I had this sort of big final history chapter where I kind of, it was sort of during the pandemic, and I kind of wanted to go back in time and tell the story. And what I found was that when we want to think about the maze and why it's structured the way it is, I guess there's two different kinds of characters that I'm kind of foregrounding in my story. One would be these speculators. It could be Goldman Sachs. It could be individual hedge funds. Now, if I was writing, I'd be writing about BlackRock. It's got $20 trillion underneath management, right? So there's that side of the story. And how I talked about that was more in terms of, what are the incentives to speculators? What are the games that are being played? What are the new trading strategies? And what's the relationship between them, right? So that was how I thought about them, less as individuals and more as like a system of incentives, or like a game. The other aspect of this was, well, who's providing those incentives, right? If the speculators are responding to a kind of market structure, who's structuring the market? And what I ended up writing about and researching a lot was central bankers, right? Alan Greenspan, I've already mentioned. Paul Volcker's also another kind of crucial figure in this story, but also his predecessor, Arthur Burns, as well. And so what you kind of begin to see from Arthur Burns through Volcker, and especially to kind of Greenspan, is these, if you like, as thing, they're all chairmen of the Federal Reserve, and they are essentially kind of through their own political entrepreneurial activities, right? These weren't necessarily things that they like had to do. They just kind of wanted to do them, or they felt it was important to further, however they thought about it, the stability of American finance, .. And so, for example, the 1970s, right? So often we hear about the 1970s as these oil shock years, 1973, OPEC, in the OPEC embargo, 1979, the Iran oil crisis. What does that happen? Just like now, you get the surge of worldwide inflation. You have the biggest stock market crash since 1929. You have the birth of stagflation, unemployment's rising. It's a chaos. It's not considered like a happy time, right? We think about, especially in the West, the last 50 years. But the story keeps going, and it keeps going into the 1980s, because of Arthur Burns, right? So what ends up happening is developing countries in especially Latin America, but also the Middle East and Asia, have to borrow a lot of money to pay for these oil imports, right? So oil is denominated in dollars. So what do you do if you're, say, Peru? You go to an American bank like Citi, and Citi at the time had tons of money because they had all their branches in Saudi Arabia, right? So Citi has a ton of oil money. Peru wants the oil. They've got to borrow dollars to buy the oil. And this is happening everywhere. And then in 1976, Peru gets into trouble. It can't pay back the loans. And Arthur Burns begins to freak out, right? It's a bit of a Lehman Brothers moment. I suppose now that's how we would think about. Like, if these countries in Latin America start defaulting on their debt to private American banks, you could end up with a kind of Lehman Brothers situation. Like, the whole kind of house of cards of American finance would collapse. Mm-hmm. And so what Burns does is he instructs the IMF, which the US has a disproportionate amount of power over, to go to Peru and say, right, you've got to cut your budgets. You'll do everything in your power to pay back the American banks. It doesn't really work. The government gets thrown out. The IMF has to go back the next year. But this sort of becomes a model, right? So for the third world debt crisis is essentially driven by the IMF becoming the American bank's debt collector. And it was Arthur Burns who kind of built this. And what happens when you go to countries and say you've got to cut things? What do they cut? Food subsidies, right? So in Tunisia, 1984, the IMF comes in, tells Bourguiba, you've got to cut food subsidies. What happens? There's riots, just like there were in 2010.
And this actually paves the way for Ben Ali to become the new dictator of Tunisia, because it was such a fatal blow to his regime. And so what I ended up finding was that if you want to tell the story of this maze of opportunity and constraint that we're all living in, not just us, right? It's me, it's you, it's Putin, it's Boris Johnson, it's Joe Biden. We're all living in this maze. And for me, what I found in my research was it was really built by these individual central bankers.
So two last questions here. One, do you just have a, and once again, this is, like you said, it's learned gonzo journalism here. So I don't think you need to have a specific policy recommendation takeaway, but is there one? If you hear this status quo that you're describing, is there something a listener should take away as this is something we should change? This is something that could be managed. How do you think about that?
I think about it in terms of what the promise of finance was, right? So the promise of finance, whether it was when futures were invented in the sort of modern futures, I should say, in the middle of the 19th century, or even sort of now, right? The promise of finance is to kind of bring order and stability to our lives, right? Whether it's you're getting home insurance, so if your house burns down, you've got, you know, you're not completely screwed. Whether it's you have a business and you need a loan so that you can buy the spare parts you need to kind of make products and sell them. Finance is there to help us. It's there to kind of provide order to our lives. And I think the question we have to ask is that true? Right? Is that what finance is doing? And I think that you don't have to go back that far just to say the 1990s, where finance was at least doing a much better job than it's doing now, right? We didn't have crazy commodity price swings. We weren't like bundling up every single asset imaginable into sort of these private equity firms that are now running hospitals and nursing homes and so forth in the United States. The nature of finance has changed, and I don't think it's made our lives any better. And so I think it's not unreasonable to say, you know, why can't we go back to the 1990s, right? It's not that crazy. When I think often the way in which these arguments get framed is you can either have the free market or you can have the USSR. And nobody wants to go back to the USSR, so we have the free market. And what I try and track in this book is how the free market itself fundamentally changed, right? And so even you have, for example, Milton Friedman, the kind of arch neoclassical economist, he was against central bank independence, right? He tried to get Paul Volcker replaced with a computer precisely for this reason, right? Friedman was arguing in the 60s, if we let these central bankers wield all this power, they're just going to govern in favor of finance because that's who's going to staff the banks. And sort of weirdly, what's happened is that Friedman was right? In the sense that the modern central banking has allowed a financial takeover of our economy, and that free market idea that him and Hayek were sort of arguing for, I don't think really exists.
And last question, given the fact that we should think of the but once again, metaphor on metaphor on metaphor on metaphor stacked okay. up here, if we should think of these prices as these real butterfly wings that can flap and then cause a tsunami, an ocean away, do you have any speculation on how we should think of the price spikes that have followed Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Yes, it's extremely worrying. And this is actually what I'm trying to get my head around right now. I mean, we're seeing the birth of a global food crisis, right? So to recap, you had a spike in the oil markets 2021, we have a war in Ukraine, and now we have a spike in the wheat markets. We saw a very, very, very similar pattern in 2010, right? It was the other way around. Wheat price spike, riots from revolutions, and because it was riots from revolutions where they produce oil, we had an oil price spike, and that's what funded the Kremlin's invasion of Ukraine in 2014, right? So, and another global food crisis could spark not just riots or revolutions, but it could also spark more wars and more refugee crises, which of course could also be priced, quote, back into the markets, right? And I think that's what I mean about this engine. we didn't really outline all of it, but across the 2010, you have, you know, food, oil, coffee are kind of all working with each other and in tandem. And what I fear is, just like in the 1970s and just like with the last decade, we're already seeing the next crisis, right? Oil Ukraine is just kind of phase one. And then this summer we could see a food crisis. And then next year we could see new riots, new evolutions, new civil wars. And just for reference, in Kazakhstan, in January of this year, the government was overthrown for a hike in fuel prices, right? So this is happening all the time, right? This isn't like, oh, 10 years ago, the world's changed. It's like, no, actually, January 4th, the government fell over this issue, right? The world is very, very brittle. We live on the edge of chaos, and it just takes these shocks from the international markets to unleash a kind of, you know, Pandora's box of monsters. And that's, you know, ultimately what we're seeing now and what we saw in the 2010s.
Yeah, I just want to call out two things. Rupert, you have two first names. It's very, very difficult to deal with.
Sorry, when I'm
looking at the Zoom screen here. No, but Rupert, I think people underestimate how difficult it is to speak for an hour. So I think we'll forgive your voice giving out at minute 58. And then two, we should give a shout out. You have two dogs with you right now, and you were afraid they were going to make noise, and they did their work today. We had a disastrous dog episode. This was the peak dogs did not cause noise thing. So I want our audio listeners too, to get the shout out as well for that.
Thank you for not barking.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So we'd love you just to shout the show. So of course, you move books, I don't move books. Please shout the book's name out for folks who want to learn more about this topic.
Sure. Yeah. If you'd like to sort of find out more about this and get into the nitty gritty, the book is called Price Wars, How the Commodity Markets Made Our Chaotic World.
Excellent. Rupert, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thanks so much, man.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.